Hey, comedy fans, welcome to another edition of the Comedy at the Carlson Cast. I'm your host, Vinny Paulino. Today, our guest joining us in studio is Mike Young. Today's episode, as always, is brought to you by our friends at Three Heads Brewing, the makers of Rochester's most delicious beer. Remember, drink responsibly, do good things, and always be kind. Let's start the show. Good morning, Carlson Casters. My guest today has been performing stand-up for over 20 years. He's a writer, producer, and director of soon-to-be three feature films. Today, we're going to find out who the F Mike Young is. Hey, Mike Young.
How are you, man? Thanks for having me in this awesome cave.
It is a bit of a cave.
It's great, bro. I live here.
I practically do.
I see that. You fit right in.
I actually could lean against the wall and no one would notice me.
Yeah,
like,
no.
Like, just, you could pan right over.
Just another character in here.
There it is.
Yeah.
So thank you for being here so early, and welcome to Rochester.
Thanks for having me, man. Rochester is cool. I was here with Saget 2 years ago.
Okay.
You know, didn't really take a look at the city, but yesterday I did a little good 3-4 mile walk around Rochester, saw the old mansions. Saw what this place probably used to be.
Oh, man. Back in the day, this place used to be great.
Yeah.
But listen, before you start throwing the stones, Captain Detroit.
Yeah, no, not throwing stones, by the way. I dug the mansions. I'm like, I guess they turned some of these big properties into apartments.
Yeah, it's kind of a shame.
Yeah, I mean, it reminds me of some of Detroit. Like, Detroit, you know, had its moments. It had its heyday. And then, you know, had some rough moments and turned some of those old, like the Motown mansions and stuff like that into, you know, multifamily homes and property. So it'll come back, you know, but it's just a lot of character around here. I like it.
Well, you have some interesting travels. You were in L.A. and you just moved back to Detroit?
Yeah, man. I've been in L.A., you know, 19 years. And it's funny, when you're a comedian and you travel all the time, you never feel like you're even home. Like, right. I never even felt like LA was home. I've been there 19 years, and I never never felt homey. I got all my friends there. We play ball. We hang out, you know. But, like, every Thursday I leave. Every Sunday I'm back. And it's like you got 3 days. So I'm back in Detroit now. I got engaged. You know, it's a whole story.
Well, congratulations.
Thank you very much.
Not about the Detroit thing, but congratulations on the engagement.
I appreciate it. Yeah. Okay. But I was in LA forever and traveling, doing stand-up, shooting movies. Both my movies before this were shot in New York. So I was in New York for like 6 months twice. And I just said, you know what? Let me just go back home and see if I can jet out of Detroit Metro Airport, still go on the road, still do my thing with comedy. And turns out, you know, I go home, I get engaged in Michigan, I'm shooting my next movie in Detroit, and I'm like, I'm in no rush to go back anywhere. So yeah, I am back home in Detroit living and kind of loving it. And I can go to LA for a week here, 2 weeks there. You don't have to be there, man. I was paying so much money in rent, I can't even believe, I was like tricked.
I think it's amazing how show business has changed, along with every other business in the world, once we all realize you don't have to be in a central location.
Absolutely.
The technology has caught up with us.
It's caught up with us, and it's like, what did I have, one meeting every 2 months in L.A.? Like, everyone's so busy in L.A. Like, oh, I got a meeting. How many meetings did I have?
But you
got
to leave for that meeting, you know, like now to get to it.
Exactly. I'll drive to that meeting from Rochester. And whatever happened to those meetings, you know what I mean? Maybe I book one job out of 7 meetings. And it's like, you know what? Let me go live where I want to live. Let me have my life. And then I'll go to Los Angeles when I need to. I mean, I still, you know, I love LA. I may end up back there at some point or have a place there. But I'm loving being home. Michigan's incredible. Detroit's my heart. You see it in my act. I talk about it all the time.
Yeah.
And yeah, man, I'm just returned. You know, I return to the roost.
All right. Well, before we get too far into this, I want to remind everybody watching that the text line is open. You can text your questions into 585-484-0265. And if you want to get your tickets to see Mike Young, they're available right now at carlsoncomedy.com. So you're filming your third movie.
Yeah.
Currently.
Yep. This is actually my fourth film. My third writing and directing movie.
Right.
I wrote and directed My Man is a Loser with Stamos and Michael Rapaport was my first one. A stand-up guy we did for Netflix. And then this is called Stealing Jokes. But in between all that, I wrote a movie and produced a movie called Adam with Jeff Daniels and Aaron Paul. That's out on Amazon right now.
Wow, okay.
Yeah, it's called Adam. It's heavy. I wrote it as
A
a
drama.
bro, I wrote it as a dark comedy. This is how movies go.
Okay.
I wrote it. It was based on a true story about a kid who had this tragic accident, ended up in a wheelchair, was trying to get his life together, and everybody around him was a disaster. So he had a journal that he had written about his life, 500-page journal. The producers of the
Right.
movie called me, said, "Read this journal. We want you to possibly write this film." I read the journal. I said, "This is the funniest but yet most tragic story I've ever." I said, "This is incredible." So I wrote it first as a dark comedy. I thought I had like Little Miss Sunshine in a wheelchair. I'm like, this is my Oscar. It's the best thing I ever wrote in my life. I can't even believe, I don't even have to work at this because the whole movie's in the journal. I just lifted it from the journal, put it in format, and we were good to go. Cut to like a year later, the producers were like, we gotta redo a rewrite on this. And then they brought in a writer to like do a pass on what I had written. It started to slowly become more of a drama. So the movie's still good. And but it didn't, it isn't what I really thought it was going to be, but that's just the way movies go. There's so many
So,
people involved that you don't know what your movie. It's amazing any movie ever gets made, bro. Let's just put it like that.
yeah, I gotta ask. So, like, when you have a movie that's based on an actual real person's journal, does that person have the t any input into that?
This person did in the beginning. This kid,
Okay.
Adam Nisgar, who, rest in peace, man. He passed away from complications from the injury. But he had a say in this for a while, just an opinion. He didn't have a strong say
Sure.
because the money guys still kind of overruled everybody. But usually, no. Usually, you will just purchase, you will option his story, and he's out. That's
Yeah.
usually how it goes. We option your story, we turn your story into whatever we
In
want.
this version, Adam, you can walk and you work.
You start off, yeah, you
Yeah.
walk through the whole movie, and at the end you walk on water, and it's all a metaphor for what happens in the Bible.
Perfect.
Yeah. But usually,
Cut, print, perfect.
yeah, and it's done. But usually you have no say. I don't want to, talk negative about movies or Hollywood or this and that. It's just hard. There's so many people involved in making a movie that to keep the original vision is what you're trying to hold on to.
Well, you're directing, and that's like the
A lot.
job of the director is to like focus the vision for everyone.
Totally.
How do you even approach that? Like, I can't even get my mind around that. I can barely do stand up. Like,
It's a lot, man. So I do some, I meditate. I just try to keep a steady brain.
sure.
But with directing, listen, I'm not Tarantino, bro. I'm not the greatest director. I would come from the world of stand-up comedy. I also simultaneously was always a writer. So in my first movie, they let me direct because I convinced them to let me direct. I didn't go to film school. I barely even knew how to run a camera. I
Okay,
didn't
okay.
understand 35 millimeter to, to, I didn't understand anything. So I just knew that I knew the story inside and out on my first movie. I knew the beats. I knew the end to the scene. I knew the out. I knew the transitions. So I told the money guys, they were actively looking for a different director at the time. So they
Okay.
loved the script. And I said, please let me direct this. I promise. So
Nothing could ever go wrong giving someone their first opportunity to direct a film.
$5 million I had to make this movie. What could possibly go wrong?
Nothing.
Nothing. So they give me, they green light it.
Okay.
And, actually, the story is really cool because Doug Allen, the creator of Entourage, was a good friend of mine.
Okay.
These guys knew Doug. They called Doug. They say, man, this guy, Mike Young, says he could direct the movie. Doug goes, a fucking monkey could direct the movie. Let him direct the movie. Doug, bless his heart, he vouched for me. They let me direct the movie. It was a success. We sold it to Lionsgate. What I did was I just read every book on directing. I read interviews with directors. I studied up on like Tarantino style. I studied up on like Woody Allen style of directing. And I read like the Playboy. There was a Playboy book of interviews with directors, like everyone from like Zemeckis to, God, I'm just blanking on every director, but from Zemeckis
Yeah.
to Tarantino, every single director was interviewed in this book.
That's way more homework than I would have done. I would have done a YouTube search, how to direct a movie.
So in
and
this
clicked
book,
on the shortest link.
Totally. But like Barry Levinson. But in this book, there was a running theme. A lot of these directors, A, started in stand-up comedy. Mike Nichols, Barry Levinson, even Tarantino dabbled in stand-up early on.
I had no idea that he did, really.
Yeah, he loved comedy. So I realized a lot of these guys just understood like rhythm, timing, beats, and then they just dove into directing and then studied the craft after they got into it.
Yeah.
So I was like, I could definitely do this. And I just studied as much as I could. Even though you study as much as you can, everything's still going to go wrong.
Sure, sure.
Day one, I was a nervous wreck. The first day I directed, I'll never forget. It was like a scene with Stamos and Rappaport on like a bench in a park.
Okay.
And I was like, I told the DP, I was like, all right, now when you get to Stamos, just zoom in. He's like, zoom in? There's no zooming, bro. Like, these cameras don't zoom. This is a $500,000 camera. They don't zoom, buddy. You got to change a lens. It's going to take 40 minutes. So I learned a ton. I mean, it was a learning experience. And I just learned as I went along, and I had a great DP and a great AD. And you hire better, smarter people than you to be all around you, and you go. And so I learned a lot on My Man Is a Loser. And then by the time I directed a stand-up guy,
yes,
I was flying. I just, like, I knew what I was doing way more.
Now, those
more.
Were about 2 years apart.
They were actually, timeline-wise, probably yes, but okay. After the premiere of My Man Is a Loser in LA, unbeknownst to me, the producers who were going to be the producers of a stand-up guy, they were at the premiere. So after the premiere of the movie, this little funny Israeli dude and his finance guy come up to me. They're like, hey, bro, we want to make a movie with you. We thought that movie was so funny. I'm going to call you in 2 weeks. And one of the dudes was a friend of mine, Danny A, who was in a stand-up guy.
Yeah.
So Danny
was the star of the movie, wasn't he?
He's the star of the movie. So yeah. Danny A is at my premiere, and he's got this finance guy from Israel, I swear to God, who's at the premiere. I'm thinking nothing of it. They come up to me afterwards. Mike, my guy Ron loves your movie. We want to talk to you. So I'm thinking, there's no way I'm going to be able to get another movie right after this movie. Sure enough, 2 weeks later, Danny calls me with this guy. He's like, I got an idea. You're going to direct this new movie. Here's my idea. He tells me this idea. It's not a good idea.
Okay.
I just tell him straight up. I mean, he tells me he wants to do a movie about a guy who used to be a basketball player who goes back to college at 40 years old. He plays on the team. It's like they could have been something.
That movie's been made.
7 times in all different sports. So I always had this idea of like, what if a guy, you know, I come from Detroit, so I know some shady people in my life, and I've been around organized crime a little bit in my life.
Hey, Joe, you're all good, buddy. Don't stress. Sorry.
That's okay. Joe's stressing.
Yeah, I'm just watching. Here's the fun thing, folks. Those of you who are watching live, I'm watching our producer figure something out, and there was just a little hiccup. He fixed it. He's all good.
We're good. Okay, cool.
I just worry, Mike. I'm sorry.
Are you kidding? You're doing everything, bro. I understand where you're coming from. So Danny A.
We need to change a lens. Can we change a lens?
Change a lens. Zoom in on Vinny.
Please don't.
So Danny says he has this idea, but the whole time I'm thinking, I've had this idea in my head of a stand-up guy for so long. Because I told the story on stage last night, but unfortunately, like, I got caught up in like this weird organized crime situation years ago.
Okay.
It's a long story, Vinny. I'll tell you another time.
Fair enough.
Bottom
I'm sure you'll be back. Well,
I'm fine. It's all good. But I got in trouble. I did get in trouble for a while. So in my mind, and by the way, I was still a comedian. I was 15 years deep into comedy. I was never going to quit comedy. But I always had this thought, if I ever had to go into the witness protection program, would I just not be funny anymore and like change my whole career? So I had this idea of a guy going into the program and he's accidentally funny and he becomes famous while he's in the program, which is a nightmare for anybody in witness protection.
Absolutely.
So I pitched Danny A that movie and he goes, I love it. Let's do it. Go ahead, write the movie. Call me when it's done. So I write a stand-up guy.
Okay.
And we literally, you know, 4 months later, we are in pre-production in New York City, and boom, I had my second movie up and running.
That's a whirlwind.
It was a whirlwind, and it was like, but it's funny, Vinny, I'm such an insecure comedian at the end of the day that I swear to God, I always think that it's over. I always am thinking, yeah, I did get another movie, and it happened kind of fast, but like, now tomorrow, I got nothing. Like, it's going to be over tomorrow. Like, I just have like this feeling of, that's what an entrepreneur feels like
all the time.
And that's what a comedian feels. You never know when it's going to be over. So yes, it was, I didn't take the time to go, I'm so grateful. This is amazing that I got another movie right after my first movie. I was thinking, like, how am I gonna live for the next 5 years? Like, yeah, this is great now.
Right.
Which is, I would say to anybody out there, just focus on the work at hand and you're gonna be fine if it's good. Just
Yeah.
make something good and you're always gonna be fine. I really do believe that. And we made a stand-up guy. We had some good, Danny A and I were friends before that and are still great friends. But there was a good tumultuous battle because not only was he the lead of my
Huh.
movie, he was the finance. He got me the money for the movie.
Sure.
So, in my mind, I have a certain vision and I'm the director and you got to listen to my vision. But he's also the lead of my movie and he's the money. So
Yeah,
he,
but you're the director and the writer.
which is totally enough. And I'm good with that. And I am the director and the writer. But the money always can, says they're the boss, Dan, Vinny. They're always the
Hollywood.
boss. That's Hollywood. So, like, for instance, it was like a throwback style movie and it was gangster, it was underworld, it was fun. I loved it. I really enjoyed doing it. But I had like this thought, I had this like musical thought, and I was like, I got the greatest idea ever in music. I'm like,
Okay.
Danny, we're gonna do doo-wop music. Acapella as our whole soundtrack. I tell the music supervisor, he's like, I love it. It's genius, bro. We got to pitch it to Danny. He's the money. I
Okay.
tell Danny, hey, listen to this, bro. We're going to do doo-wop music as our soundtrack. He's like, that is the worst idea I've ever heard in my life. We're never going to do that. Forget it. So I would have battles like that. I
Okay.
would have creative wars like that. So for 3 weeks, I wouldn't talk to him because I'm like, so passionate about the movie that I'm like, that is a great idea. You're not seeing it. But bottom line
That's got to
is,
be very hard.
it's torture on your heart and on
Yeah.
your head. But at the end of the day, you got to go, you know what? We got to work together as a unified front to make something great. So you just put all your effort into trying to get everyone on your team, and you got to work with 50 people, man. And that's really the hook of being a director. You keep the vision as strong as you can. You hope that everybody, has the level of care that you do,
Right.
and you just move forward as a front, but it ain't easy and you're gonna have battles along the way and you hear about them all the time. That's why you hear things about, Tarantino punching a producer in the face in a restaurant.
Sure.
Because when you're passionate about a story and you love it, you're not gonna care more than me about my story. You know what I
Right.
mean?
It's very getting people on board with a vision is a mind-boggling thing to even attempt to do anyway.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
And even on Stealing Jokes, which I'm, we start filming again in January, I had like a party with everybody, just like a vision party. And so, like, you ever see the movie Nice Guys with Russell Crowe?
I
And
have, yes.
yeah, so I love that movie. I love every the color palette. I love everything about it. So I had a party with like my DP and my wardrobe, and I just had a party with everybody just and I put the movie on.
Yeah.
And I just kind of like let it run in the background. I just said, everybody, just every now and then, just no pressure, but just like look up at this movie and look at how it moves and look at the color schemes in it and just look at how it feels, And so that was kind of how I started to get the feel and the vision
It's a way
for
of
this.
planting seeds of the palette that you want.
Planting seeds. Exactly. And so, yeah, man. So making a movie is, I'm super fortunate. I'm super blessed. I'm super grateful. But it is a ton of work, and you have to just find a way to like stay healthy. You know what I mean? Drink your water, or you like. There's a picture of me after a stand-up guy, bro. I got a garbage bag. I look homeless, and I'm in a subway station in New York. Like I'm just in the subway station, looking homeless, down 25, 30 pounds, stressed out.
Well, listen, man, I can't even imagine the pressure of doing a movie and being in charge of doing this, and especially like putting your own vision, getting other people to catch on to it. But I can't get my brain around stand up.
Yeah.
And you've been performing for a very, very long time, and you didn't start till a little bit later in life. I'm really
Yeah.
interested to find out like what got you to step on stage the first time.
So I was always, excuse me, I was always dreaming about being a stand-up. As a kid, I was class clown. I always loved comedy. I would study like Richard Pryor, Eddie Murphy. I would listen to their albums. I always would tell my parents and everybody, like, I'm going to be a comedian one
It's
day.
interesting that you say study their
Well,
albums, because like that kind of like denotes like it wasn't for entertainment. It was just that like
No, it was. Well, I mean, I was being entertained,
Sure.
but I was also listening to him going like economy of words and like the way they put their jokes together. And like I just was studying them. And I was also like a kid that sat in front of the TV with my brother watching Abbott and Costello and
Right.
like on Sunday mornings and like watching, you know, Cheers and just, you know, Seinfeld and just comedy after comedy. I just love comedy. I loved it. And I had a natural knack of making people laugh. But I was always too scared to do it. Like in college, like when people and friends in college would like go do an open mic, or like I had a friend Grant, who would open for like the comedians that came to town, like Barry Sobel or Seinfeld would play University of Arizona. I would be like envious and just sit back and go, "Wow, man! Like one day I'm gonna do this, but I have to like wait till I'm ready." And so I really didn't get on stage till I was probably 26, 27
Yeah.
years old at the and I started at the Comedy Store. And
Seems like a logical place to start.
I started at the craziest place you could ever
Right.
start, because everyone's like, "Where'd you start?" In Detroit? No, I started on Sunday afternoons standing in line with every degenerate in LA signing up my name to get into a lottery to hopefully get 3 minutes of time. And so that's where I started. I started late because I just wasn't ready. You know, I had it written. I had all my stuff was written. I was always like, I was rehearsing it in front of my roommates at the time in LA.
Okay.
Finally, I went up and bam, I was hooked. And after my first time doing it at the Comedy Store, I was just hooked on comedy, dedicated to the craft. And soon after, like a year in, Joe Rogan saw me and he was like, "Dude, you're funny, bro. You want to come on the road?" And it was like a miracle. I was like, I get to go on the road with Rogan, who had Fear Factor at the time. He
Yeah.
wasn't even in the UFC yet. And I was just, you know, lucky to have some people above me that thought I was talented, who brought me on the road and put me in front of real crowds, you know. But then reality check, you come back to LA and you do another Sunday night, you know, until you're passed as a regular by Mitzi Shore. And then it was off to the races. And I just fell in love with the craft. And you know, that's why like I listen to Seinfeld all the time, because he's a craftsman
Yep.
and he just looks at it like checks every word, you know, looks at his, you know, loves the writing of it, loves the organization
Absolutely.
of it. And that's kind of my, I'm not saying that's my style, but like I look at it in the same way. Like you have to be a craftsman, because I don't have the gift of being able to just like go up and riff and be funny.
Right.
I'm not a great improver. I have to write my stuff. And so I was always just simultaneously, I was always a writer, you know.
Yeah.
Even in high school, my English teacher, while I was failing everything else, my English teacher was like, "You can write, bro. Like, you're pretty much terrible in class. You're a disruptive person. You make everyone laugh. That's great. We like you, but we don't like what you do here. But you can write, so stick with this." And so I just try to keep it simple, man. Writing and stand up and see where it takes me.
It's pretty interesting.
Is it? I don't
It
know.
is though, because like a lot of people would be lost, you know, in high school when they're not doing very well in other things and they have this one thing that maybe they're good at. A lot of people like at that are so beaten down by the fact that they weren't excelling in all these other areas that like, why do I want to do any of this? You know what I mean?
Yeah, but I always got the biggest rush out of being a class clown.
There it is.
You know? Like there, even in college, when you're not even supposed to, there is no detention in college.
Right.
But even in college, I would crack up the class, and it would just always come off of something that the teacher said. Like my first, do you remember the there was a, how old are you, bro? 35, 32?
39.
Yeah, okay. Do you ever remember a commercial that was like, "Parquet butter, parquet butter"? There was this famous commercial. I was in Spanish class in college in a 500 seat auditorium, and the Spanish the Spanish teacher's up on the board,
Okay.
and he writes the word down, "Por qué, por qué," and he's saying it out loud, and I just went, "Butter." I just yelled out "butter," and it got
Lost
500.
its butt.
Bro, I blew up the room, and he didn't even know why, because he didn't like know the commercial.
Right.
But I was like, "Yo, I got it, bro. I gotta be a stand-up one day. I mean, I'm killing in class."
It got right into your bloodstream,
Went
man.
right into my bloodstream.
So you're also like into boxing and stuff like that too, aren't you?
Heavy. I love
Heavy.
boxing. So yeah, so believe it or not, my two great uncles were professional boxers. Jerry Meckler and Morty Meckler, my mom's uncles, were both professional boxers in New Jersey, New York, Detroit. You know, they traveled. They
Yeah.
had over 50 fights each. So boxing was already in my family a little bit. So as kids, we had the gloves, and then my dad was good friends with Emanuel Stewart. So Emanuel Stewart, rest his soul,
Okay.
was the greatest trainer of all time. He trained over 15 world champions, Tommy Hearns, Milt McCrory, Mike Tyson, Evander Holyfield. He had the Kronk Boxing Gym in Detroit. So as a kid, they would have the Kronk fighters come to my dad's gym where he worked out, where
Okay.
he ran. My dad used to run a gym, the place called the Southfield Athletic Club, and the fighters would come and teach kids boxing. So I gravitated to boxing really
Okay.
early.
Like,
And
how early are we talking here?
like 11, I was
Okay.
probably like 11, 10, 11 years old. Me and my brother would be, they would teach boxing. They would teach it in a racquetball court. And they would just take us through the motions, teach us just simple moves. And I was already like a natural athlete. And so I got really good quickly at boxing. I just gravitated to it. And so I stayed like working out, training. And then when I got to, through high school, I just worked out boxing. I didn't
Yeah.
join the amateurs. I didn't box in the amateurs in high school.
Sure.
But when I got to college, I did. I boxed in the amateurs. I signed up and, to be an amateur boxer. I started the U University of Arizona Boxing Club. So I started a boxing club there.
That was
And
you?
yeah, you
All
didn't
right.
hear? Yeah, you've seen the pictures.
Yeah. The
So
Arizona State Boxing Club?
University of
The
Arizona.
Uta.
It's probably
Okay, I
gone
was
by
thinking of
now.
a different one. Sorry. I'm not as
Yeah.
excited.
Yeah, you probably there probably is a big Arizona State boxing club. That wasn't me. This
Okay,
was a
okay.
U of A boxing club where we would like there was like eight of us. And they were all other, eight other boxers who happened to go to college at the same time. And we would travel around Arizona and fight in tournaments. And so we just boxed in tournaments in Arizona. And my trainer at the time was Tony Ayala Sr., who was like his son was a famous fighter and
Right.
went to prison. Blah blah blah, and he was like, basically pulled me aside one day because I was boxing in South Tucson, all Mexican black fighters. I was definitely the only Jew in the whole situation, and he was like, "Listen, man, I want to take you. You should drop out of college and box. And you, I'm going to take you, move you to Texas with our, with us. And you're gonna, I'm going to turn you. I was 178 pounds. I was like, light heavyweight."
Right.
Or cruiserweight, whatever it
Yeah, that
was.
says that not super big, but
No, but I was 178 in college, and he was like, "I'm gonna take you to Texas and turn you into a heavyweight," because he just saw money. He's like, "Oh, decent looking white boy. I'll fucking put some weight on him." But meanwhile, the whole time I'm thinking, "Bro, I don't even like getting punched by dudes 160.
right.
Like, those are heavy punches for me." So no.
You don't
And
want
plus,
to fight a dude who's starting at 220.
hell no, I'm not fighting a natural 220.
Right.
I sparred those guys, so. Bottom line was, I was really good for what I was. I was, I saw world champions coming in the gym. I saw James Lights Out Tony come in. I saw light heavyweight Michael Moore before he was a heavyweight champion of the world.
Yeah.
I saw John David Jackson. I saw all these amazing fighters and what their level was. I wasn't going to be that level,
Yeah.
but he thought I had a potential to be something. Bottom line is, I just love boxing so much because to me it's like the greatest metaphor for life.
It does fit. There's a boxing reference for everything.
For everything. It's like
There's an analogy anywhere.
you got to know when to sit back, you always got to feel out your opponent. You got to know when to attack. You got to know who you're up against.
Right.
You got to know when to just jab, just feel out the jab. You got to know how to trick somebody. There's just so many analogies in boxing. And it's a science. It is a sweet
Sure.
science. It doesn't matter how big and muscular you are. You know what I mean? Boxing is like a stay loose game. You gotta be loose. You gotta be relaxed. And it's just the most interesting sport to me because it's beautiful, but at the same time, it's brutal and it's dangerous. And I definitely have probably gotten some brain injury from it. I sparred a lot, throughout my life.
Sure.
And every now and then I will mumble and not, my memory is not great. I don't know if it's from boxing or what, or just, the weeds, smoking weed in seventh grade. I don't know what it is.
Sure.
But boxing is part of my life. And
It just kind of helps you. Did it help you?
It gets you in the best shape too, and it helps me in stand up big time.
Yeah.
Because stand up is like boxing. You know, my opponent is the audience. You sure. know what I mean? And you boxing has a rhythm to it. Comedy has a rhythm
Absolutely.
To it.
Absolutely.
There's a musicality to it, and it's just something that's in my blood. And you know, nowadays I just like hit the heavy bag and jump rope and. You know, I thought about going into like an over 40 tournament just for fun,
See
but
what
my
happens.
neck got so skinny that I'm scared that I'll just get dropped. Like, I'm just not strong like that anymore. So I just love it, man. You know, I've been around it, and one day I'll probably manage a fighter or somehow be involved, but
that's pretty cool.
It's in my family.
I feel like your stand-up style is kind of like that boxing style that you're describing. It does feel very loose. Not
Thanks.
That the jokes are loose, but your presence is very like, hey, we're here. Here we go.
Yeah.
And it's jokes. It's not, I don't feel like anything about your performances, your stand-up feels forced.
Yeah.
I feel like it feels natural and fun.
Thanks. But that comes from a lot of work to get to that, to make it look like that.
Amen. Of course.
Yeah, because there's nothing natural about comedy, like for stand-up. You know what I mean? It's like such an unnatural thing to stand up and tell stories to people and get them to laugh.
100%.
So, but thanks for saying it seems loose. I don't know if that's a good thing,
No, it is meant to be a compliment because it's a very enjoyable style.
Thanks.
It doesn't feel setup punch, setup punch, setup punch.
Yeah.
It feels very flowing.
Yeah. It's funny, man. Like, you find your style after many years. Like, in the beginning, I was like a major pacer.
Okay.
You know, and I remember Joey Diaz said to me, "Mike Young, you ain't Chris Rock. Quit pacing around, bro.
I love
what are you
Joey.
Doing?" I love Joey. And he was kind of right at the time. So for a long time, I stood still. But I actually started going back to a little bit of pacing because I am a natural pacer. Like, even on the phone, I pace. It just helps my brain when I pace. So I had to find a style that was like, land my jokes when I'm standing still, but do my setups while I'm pacing.
Yeah.
You know, so I found my, you know, it's not calculated, but it is like, you got to find your style.
100%.
And it takes a long ass time, man. And especially, I was in my stand-up groove. You know, I was on the road with Rogan. I opened for Russell Peters for a long time. I was on the road. And then when I got My Man is a Loser as a movie, I went away from stand-up for years. Like, I never didn't do it, but I wasn't in that rhythm of five shows a week.
Right.
It was like once every 2 weeks I was doing it. And so I got out of my rhythm of my stand-up where all my boys started taking off to become superstars in stand-up comedy.
Well, just on a side note, you did do a tour that you started.
Yeah.
With Sebastian.
Yeah.
And Bert Kreischer.
Yeah.
Yeah.
My tour would be worth $20 million right
Your
now.
Your tour would be unbelievable right now.
If these guys had any balls, they'd call me back and do the tour again. Like, come on, fellas. I know you're rich, but let's get going. I did. I started. Want me to tell you that story?
I love it. Absolutely.
So, you know, obviously I have an entrepreneurial brain.
Yeah.
And I love being my own boss. So 10 years ago, I'm on the patio of the Comedy Store. Sebastian's a good friend of mine. Kreischer's a good friend of mine. Brett Ernst is a good friend. We're all good friends.
Right.
We're all kind of like, no one knows any of us, but I'm thinking like, my boys are hilarious.
You're
like,
brothers in arms.
We're brothers in arms, and we are like, what could we do? Like, how do we break to the next level? And at the time, the Kings of Comedy Tour with Cedric the Entertainer, Steve Harvey, Bernie Mac was making $16 million a year on the road. They were selling arenas. So I'm watching and they're awesome. And I'm watching it was a movie. They did a movie on it. So I'm watching the movie. I'm seeing them fill houses. And I think to myself, as I'm on the Comedy Store patio one day, I'm looking at Sebastian. You know what I mean? He's a waiter at Four Seasons, but he's also a comedian. He's coming back and he's in his waiter outfit. I'm looking at Brett Ernst. I'm looking at Tony Rock, Bobby Lee. I'm looking at Kreischer. I'm like, if that thing is making $16 million, we got at least $2 million worth of talent right here.
There it is.
Right?
There's the stable.
Boom. I have this idea. I'm like, I'm going to make a tour. And I'm going to ask my boys to be on it, and I'm going to come up with a name. And so I come up with the Young American Comedy Tour. Everyone thinks that I come up with the name because my name's Young.
Uh-huh.
I swear to God, bro, I didn't even think of my own name. I thought Young American Comedy Tour I thought about it because it was like a diverse,
like the Bowie song.
Like the Bowie song.
Yeah,
and that was our theme song, but we couldn't afford to keep playing it because it was a licensing. We didn't have that song anymore. But Young Americans to me was like, we had an Italian, we had a Jewish dude, we had an Irish dude, we had Black, we had Asian. So I just created a rotating tour called the Young American Comedy Tour, and I went to the booker of the improv. Her name's Erin. I said, Erin.
And what's her number?
Yeah, I'll give it to you right now.
Great.
Yeah, 310. She's awesome. I literally went to her with a piece of paper and all the comics that said they would do the tour. I said, Erin, I got an idea. This is the Young American Comedy Tour. Me, Sebastian, Brett, and Bobby Lee, and like everybody was on it, and we would take four people to a city. And right within 10 minutes, Vinny, it was like the greatest shit ever. I'm not even kidding. She just like went on her computer, did a couple weird moves on her computer. She came back with a piece of paper. She goes, here's your offer. She made me, she offered us, she handed me 10 cities, 10 dates, and the money offer was on the thing. We had a guarantee of like, well, maybe it was like $5,000-$6,000 at the time.
Okay,
so everybody was getting like 1800, say.
Yeah.
And to me, that was like, we fucking made
for
it
for a night,
bro.
Yeah, it's a good feeling.
We made it, we're done, we fucking made it. And
young Americans,
it was off the chain, bro. So it like the first run was like me, Brett, Sebastian, and Butch Bradley.
Okay.
And we went to Tempe. We went to, you know, Denver. We went to San Jose. We went to Pittsburgh. We did like our first five cities. Then like Sebastian couldn't go, so we brought in Bobby Lee, you know. So then Bobby Lee disappeared. Boom. Then we brought in Ren Azizi and Sam Tripoli. And the Young American Comedy Tour ran for like 3 straight years.
That's crazy.
Bro, it was crazy because it was the most fun you could ever have, right? I mean, it was just our friends on tour. We're drinking, we're partying, women. I mean, it was fucking rock and roll. I ran the tour, so I was doing like the business end of it too.
Sure.
So I would have to like make sure Bobby Lee got up for radio at 6:30 in the morning, which is impossible. Sebastian didn't talk at the time on radio, so he was like the worst person on radio because he wasn't talking. You know what I mean?
It's hysterical.
No, because he's beyond hysterical. But in radio at the time, I don't like this. What is? I don't like this. So Brett would do all the talking, and. Bro, it was just like, I wish we could recreate it and redo it again because it was the most fun we ever had.
I think you'd get your 16 mil now.
Bro, I swear to God. And the funny thing was, I wasn't a good business person. I really wasn't, because the owner, Robert Hartman, of the improv chain, he sat me down one day and was like, do you have any partners in this? So I'm thinking he's like either leaning towards he wants to be my partner, or he just wants, I don't know what I'm thinking. I don't have a manager doing anything for me. I'm thinking maybe he wants to just take the tour on his own. I don't know what the hell is going on. So he's like, do you want any partners on this? So I'm thinking, bro, yes, I'd love partners, but I'm also thinking he wants half the tour.
Sure.
So I say, no, I'm not really looking for partners. But meanwhile, my stupid ass, I was looking for partners, and I should have just partnered with him and let him do all the booking and like all the business of it.
Yeah.
Because I was babysitting friends and making sure we got to our show and having a good time. But we did it for 3 years. Everybody had an amazing time. People still talk about it all the time because it was just the most fun you could have. You know, we all came on stage afterwards. And I tried to build what would have become something like the Blue Collar Comedy Tour. And I, you know, wanted to develop sitcoms for all of us. But everybody went off. Like, Kreischer was the first one to leave because he was starting to get real money.
Right.
So I thought $1,800, you know, for the city was like amazing. I found out, you know, he's going to wherever to make $5,000. I'm like, yeah, I wouldn't come back either.
Right.
So we lost him. And I ran it till we couldn't run it anymore. Bro, I gotta tell you a story. So Brett and Sebastian called me one day, and they're like, listen, are we partners on this, or are we just like works for hire? And again, I don't know what the fucking answer is.
Right.
I don't know what the answer is. I'm not having a big vision on it. I didn't have a big vision picture
of it. Past the $1,800 a night.
I didn't have the vision that I should just make all my boys partners and let us all just go off. Because I had worked so hard, like I did the photo shoots, I got us, you know, all the press, I set up everything. And so I was thinking, motherfucker, if you want to be a partner, let's all work together on this. Let me stop stressing out and let's all put effort in.
Right.
And so the answer should have been yes, let's be partners. But instead I was like, well, really, you guys are works for hire, because I'm basically paying myself the same, but I'm doing all the work. So I didn't have the right answer on that one either. And I should have just made everybody an equal partner, and we would have had the biggest comedy tour. That shit would have been Netflix, I mean, HBO. We'd have done whatever we wanted. I could have kept the band together, and we would have developed shows for everybody, because that's how I think.
Yeah. What an interesting, like, kind of cautionary tale.
Yeah, just make everyone your partner so that everybody wants to work towards the same thing. I just didn't know at the time what answer they were looking for, because everyone was so desperate to go off and make be a headliner on their own that they were just thinking also they're going to leave anyway.
Right.
So to me, I was just, in my mind, I was like, let me build the most fun tour and see how big I can get it. And we ended up like the big, you know, we ended up playing like 2,000 people at the Royal Oak Music Theater and venues like that. And it got to be pretty big and fun, but I couldn't hold on to everybody. You know, I didn't have contracts. And,
you know, it's not a bad idea to create ownership and things like that with other people.
Totally. It's a great idea. And from now on, that's what I'll do. Is just let everybody be a partner. And I don't care if I have to do the extra stuff.
Fine, Mike. I'll be your partner on the next tour.
Vinny, congratulations. Thank you. Vinny and Mike Productions.
There it is.
I'll tell you one funny thing, right? So, like, I set up one of my friends at the time is a photographer.
Okay.
He shoots for Leonardo DiCaprio. He's shooting for, like, celebrity photographer stuff. My boy Peter. So I tell Peter, I got this tour and I want to do a photo shoot for us, like a real cool, edgy shoot. We're going to go around LA. All
right.
Okay. So one of the places that we end up shooting at is Leo's house. But I don't tell Kreischer, Steve Byrne, Butch Bradley, Sebastian. I don't tell them that. I don't tell Brett Ernst. I don't tell them that we're going to Leo's house. I just don't, because Leo was nice enough to like let us use his house. Sure. He wasn't there, but he let us use his house. He's got cameras all over for security reasons, whatever. Sure. So we go and we're shooting in his backyard, and his backyard looks over all of Los Angeles, and Peter's shooting us, and fucking Kreischer, he's already got like a naked problem, you know what I mean, at the time. This is before he took his shirt off at every show.
Sure.
Next thing I know, fucking Kreischer's on camera and he's butt ass naked at Leo's house in the backyard. I still don't tell him that we're at Leo's house. I'm just like, yo, bro, can you maybe just put pants on? You know what I mean? Like, just trust me, like, this guy's nice enough to let us use his house, just there's cameras, you know. But the cover of the Young American Comedy Tour, Kreischer's in the middle with an ass shot, you know what I mean?
Right, right.
He just turns around and everybody else is in clothes, but we have this amazing shot overlooking the city of Los Angeles, and nobody knew that it was at Leo's house. I didn't tell him for like 2 years.
That's hysterical.
Yeah.
You didn't want to tell him in the car on the way out?
No, because I just didn't want him to know where he lived.
That's a good point.
You know, like, I was just being cool.
Now,
I just
where exactly does he live?
Yeah, he's 8162 Sunset
Mind
Drive.
Mind Your Business Drive.
Yeah. That's the one. Yeah, go somewhere else drive.
That's it. That's it.
We had fun, man. And, you know, Kreischer still to this day just talks about how much fun we had, you know. And, but, you know, everyone brings it up. I don't know how I could, I can't redo it just because Sebastian's making those millions on his own. Kreischer's making great money. They're all killing it on their own.
They are.
They don't need money.
Congratulations, guys.
You're welcome, bro.
Yeah, man.
You're welcome.
There he is, ladies and gentlemen, the architect of all of it. All of their success. You heard it here on the Carlson Cast. None of them would have career. No, I'm just kidding.
No, but the funny thing, I enjoy building things. And I enjoy like creating stuff.
I'm with you with that. I think there's nothing better than looking down and seeing, wow, we actually, look how far we came. Look at what we did.
And it was fun doing it. Even putting the photo shoots together and doing the marketing for it. I loved it, man. I loved every aspect of it. I just wish I was a smarter businessman at the time and I knew about, you know, shared ownership. I just wish I would have done that, because we'd all be just, you know, we'd be doing this from a spaceship.
Well, speaking of fun, this weekend here at the Carlson, you could see Mike Young for 4 more shows. There's 2 tonight, 2 tomorrow. You get your tickets at carlsoncomedy.com. And Mike's new movie, Stealing Jokes, when is it going to be out?
That's a great question, man. How about first, when is it going to be shot?
Okay, when is it going to be shot?
Yes.
January.
Yeah, so we started shooting, and 5 days in, one of my lead actors, Frankie Quinones, who will probably be here at some point, great comedian, great actor, he got COVID. So he came to the set, or he didn't come to set. He tested positive for COVID. No. We shut down. Excuse me. So we shut down. 10 days later, my lead actress, she gets it. So now we got two shutdowns. So all of a sudden, like, here we are 5 days in, and we just said, you know what? Let's push pause on the whole production until January. We didn't want to run into Thanksgiving. We didn't want to run into Christmas. And all of a sudden you're dealing with this stuff. And so it shut us down, and we'll shoot. We got 21 days left of shooting. We start up in end of January. And, yeah, man, it's called Stealing Jokes. I'm the writer director. And this has been another, you know, great process of like getting a movie made. And I'm super lucky and fortunate and grateful that it's, isn't that like the new thing to say you're grateful?
Yeah.
Everyone's grateful. Am I grateful? I don't fucking know, bro. Of course I'm grateful.
Yeah. It could be worse.
I'm grateful that I wake up every day.
Yeah.
I'm grateful that I'm alive. So we start shooting end of January. Dan Gilbert, owner of the Cleveland Cavaliers, Quicken Loans, you know, incredible businessman, incredible guy. He financed that movie, Adam, I was talking about.
Yeah.
He is the financer of this movie.
Oh, wow.
So he is producer and financing the film. So we're shooting in Detroit. And so all this, it's just all grand irony, man, that I came back to Detroit. I ended up getting engaged in Detroit. And now I'm shooting my next movie in Detroit with Detroit money.
It's all full circle, baby.
Full circle.
I love it.
So yeah.
Let me ask you this one question before we get out of here. You did a movie with Stamos. You've done a million things with Saget. He's your good buddy.
He's my guy, yeah.
Come see him and make sure you put in good words. He'll do the show.
He's doing it. He's excited. He was here last time. I was with him. He loves this place.
Can't wait to have him back.
Yeah.
But are you ever going to get Dave Coulier in one of these movies, or is he just out in the cold?
Dave Coulier, I don't even think he cares about doing a movie. He just seems like a cool dude who's like, Jesus, Coulier.
There it is.
You know? And he was actually on my hockey team in L.A. We played hockey in a men's league together.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, he's a damn good hockey player.
I actually think I knew that about him. He's really into it.
Way into it. You know, yeah. Red Wing fan. He's a Detroiter. And so I know him through that, but I don't know him as well as I know Bob and Stamos. But if Coulier wants to be in my movie, he is more than welcome.
I'm just saying, get the trifecta in that.
Totally.
All right, folks. Mike Young, he's your headliner this weekend here at the Carlson. Get your tickets now, carlsoncomedy.com. And you can follow Mike Young wherever you follow anyone, Instagram, Twitter, at Mike Young, right?
At The Real Mike Young.
At The Real Mike Young.
And just check my special, Who the F is Mike Young, on Bill Burr's new All Things Comedy Network.
All Things Comedy, which is an amazing website, by the way.
Thanks, man.
It's a great website.
I didn't build it. I don't know why I just said thanks, but yeah.
Yeah. You're welcome.
Yeah. No, but Burr is so cool, man. Like, they kept me on the cover of that website forever because Who the F is Mike Young is, like, doing pretty well as a special for them. And that's the same concept as the Young American Comedy Tour. They have a whole network dedicated to comedy for comedians, by comedians, with comedians. And it's like, you know, there you go, bro. Your whole talent pool is in one spot.
Great content. Allthingscomedy.com.
Yep.
The Real Mike Young. And folks, we will be back next week with Robert Kelly. Hope to see you then. Until then, act right and we'll see you at a show. Thanks for watching. Thank you for being awesome and watching another episode of the Carlson Cast. Don't forget we're streaming live on Facebook and YouTube every Friday morning. You could also follow us on social media on Twitter and Instagram at CarlsonCast. You can listen anytime on iTunes, Google Play, and we're now available on Spotify. You should also check out an amazing app called Laughable. And on the Laughable app, you can connect to your favorite comedians in a way you never thought you could before. Download it in the App Store and visit CarlsonCast.com for information on more shows. And don't be a jerk. Rate and review.